axes, a rake, and a hoe, and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers. We discuss gardening issues seasonally and describe the events and educational services we provide. Outstanding in their field segments are an opportunity to introduce our most outstanding volunteers individually. Cross-pollinating stories will discuss the activities of Master Gardeners in additional roles. From time to time, we will go live for a call-in show when a particularly urgent topic arises. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. This program is broadcast by courtesy of WGXC Radio 90.7 FM. I'm Teresa Golden, and with me is Jean Thomas. We are two of the Master Gardener volunteers who help to educate county residents on a variety of community horticultural topics. The topics for this segment are wildflowers and foraging. Joining us for this discussion is Tracy Testo, a program coordinator in the area of natural resources and the environment for Cornell Cooperative Extension. Tracy leads groups into the wilderness of the Siuslaw Forest and other venues. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Tracy, tell us a little about your background and your mission at Cornell Cooperative Extension.
Sure. So I studied plant sciences at SUNY Cobleskill. I originally thought I wanted to go into maybe more traditional agriculture, perhaps vegetable production, and I quickly became really enthralled and curious about the natural world and our existing forested systems. I then learned that there's a lot of things that can be eaten that are already just growing out there and a lot of beautiful plants that I like to engage with. So I shifted my focus a little bit and started to hone in on ecology and forested systems, and that's what brought me to Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. My draw to that association was the Agroforestry Resource Center. That is what I would say is my specialty. I focus on opportunities that exist in woodlands that landowners or professionals might not be keyed into and try to help shift their focus towards things that might be fruitful, pun intended.
Let's start with the Siuslaw Forest. What exactly is it? I'm told it's a teaching and model forest, but what happens there beside a place to find wildflowers and go foraging?
Quite a bit. It has a really rich history. A landowner who still resides within the model forest has been the caretaker since the late 50s, early 60s. It was originally an American tree farm, but now it's evolved into one of the four New York City watershed model forests. So it's an opportunity to show how you can have a working forest, whether it be timber harvest or agroforestry opportunities, while still maintaining a healthy ecosystem and high water quality. We use it for many aspects of our work at CCE. 4-H educators use it to bring kids into the woods to learn about water quality, for example. We use it for our walks, and we maintain a whole host of demonstrations with interpretive signage to engage the public, whether we're there to lead them or not.
So can the public just go wandering in there anytime? It's open at all times?
It's not open at all times. It's open when the office is open, so that's Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30. But we do encourage the public to come use it at their will. A lot of people don't realize that it's open to the public. We heavily maintain trails for accessibility. There's even handicap access down to the first set of ponds in the beginning of the forest.
So it's a giant classroom.
It's a giant classroom,
okay.
Yes. And there's a lot to learn there.
So let's talk about wildflowers. What do we need to know if you'd like to learn how to identify them?
So a lot of people think that you really need to understand the full biology of wildflowers before you can really, say, key them out or figure out what's what. But there's actually just a few really simple steps that one can use to learn how to identify them. That's looking at the petals, the number of them, whether or not the flower is symmetrical or not. So that would be a regular or an irregular flower. And that's like a great first step to identifying what the plant is. Next steps are looking at the arrangement of the leaves on the plant. So whether or not they're opposite one another on a stem, alternate or whorled, meaning just a circle of flowers kind of at the base of the plant. And then that third step would be looking at the edges or margins of the leaf to see if they're entire or toothed or lobed. And that's a system from a resource that I like to utilize that makes it very approachable to learn what's what.
And that's a key that you use? What's the name of it?
That is Lawrence Newcomb's Wildflower Guide.
All right. What are the most favorite and popular wildflowers?
People are generally drawn to the showy ones. Something that comes to mind is a pink lady slipper, for example. It's a very big, bright, almost gaudy looking flower, and people just love it. Something that I try to do during my classes is draw people's attention towards maybe the smaller, more inconspicuous flowers that you would perhaps walk over and not even realize are there.
Like some of the little tiny, tiny orchids?
Like some of the really tiny orchids. Even some that maybe aren't thought to be native plants but are naturalized, ones that just exist here and have adapted to our environment. Like creeping thyme is just a beautiful flower if you really look at it closely, and people don't really recognize that maybe as a wildflower.
So non-native but not invasive are still wildflowers.
I think people generally consider the class of either native or invasive, but there's a whole gray area in between of these introduced or naturalized plants that have been here for quite some time. In some cases, we're not exactly certain when they arrived, but they're here and they coexist in our environment in a happy way, not an aggressive way like the invasives would. And they're often quite useful in many regards.
It only makes sense that wildflowers are seasonal. I have a question about a category I hear referenced. What is an ephemeral? And are they only spring flowers or are there other seasons to see them?
That's a good question. That kind of is a draw for many people to look for those ephemeral flowers. And the word itself just means short-lived. So ephemeral is generally tied to those spring ephemeral plants, where literally the plant, flowers, leaves, and all are only able to be observed during that short spring window. I don't believe there's any other plants that arise throughout the other seasons that can truly be regarded as an ephemeral. Hepatica is a good example of a beautiful spring wildflower that sometimes is mistakenly integrated into that category of ephemerals when in fact the leaves stay present all year long. So if you're sticking with the true definition, it's not actually an ephemeral plant.
So what's the name of a true ephemeral?
Dutchman's Breeches is a great example for a true ephemeral. It comes and then it goes and it's not to be seen again until spring of the next year.
What do people learn when they take your classes and go on your field trips? And how do they sign up? And how often do you have them?
With the wildflower walks, we generally do that once a year in midsummer. And when one comes to those classes, they can expect to learn how to utilize the key that I described. And just to give an example of other keys, most people think of identification books as being a dichotomous key. And that's where you would answer a question and it would send you in one of two directions. And I find those dichotomous keys to be somewhat unapproachable. You really need to know all the intricacies of the terms of the plant to follow them, and you can quickly get lost down the wrong rabbit hole. So we use that Lawrence Newcomb's Wildflower Guide and follow those three simple classifications that I described. And I teach people that system before we go out, make sure everyone's kind of comfortable and on the same page. And then we go out into generally the Sayusal Model Forest, and I have kind of a set list of plants that I follow and make sure I highlight to pull out all of the differences that one might find in the wild. So looking for those irregular flowers, those regular ones, and then anything that I know might be a draw for people. For example, if we're in a season where goldenrod is blooming and it's just everywhere, it's unavoidable and people want to talk about it. They want to know what it is. And I generally like to expand a bit beyond just identification of those flowers. I like to talk about the origin of the plant, whether it's native, if it's not, where it came from, how it got here, and then what are some uses of those plants either to the ecology or to us humans.
Do you take these walks and classes elsewhere than the Scioto Forest?
We do hold events in Hudson. Our office of CCE Columbia Green, we're a merged association, so we have access to our Acre location and our Hudson location. But we generally look to the Hudson location for other walks that I think we'll talk about later.
So do you have links available for people to study prior to heading out on their own?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. This is something that I always kind of bat around a little bit. And with a lot of this, we try to not overwhelm participants, especially before they even get in the door. I might send out an email prior to the class, just reminding folks to be ready for the weather. And I let them know what guide we're using. So if they have their own copy, they can bring it. Or if they want to get it beforehand, they can purchase the book. I always have a set of copies on hand. But I generally like to wait for people to show up. And that's part of the fun for me, is to have participants walk in the door and be just filled with wonder and excitement and questions. And I can help them navigate that excitement.
What's the best season to go out and see wildflowers? Or do you have a favorite season?
I do. And I think it's because of the timing. The spring is my favorite time.
Oh, we're hungry for color.
We're hungry for color. We're hungry for plant life. At that point, we're just ready to move on from the winter season. And I'm just ready to engage with these plants again. And those are when those spring ephemerals are out and the forest just kind of starts to wake up.
What's the rarest flower you've ever found?
I found that to be a tough question. I batted this around a little bit. We have one really interesting plant in the Scioto Model Forest, and I've never seen it anywhere else. It's a green-fringed orchid, also called a ragged-fringed orchid. It's very elusive. It shows up in our fields in the front of the forest and sometimes around the ponds, and it seems to be in a different place every year. And it blends right in with the tall grasses. So I walk by it day by day. And then, you know, every once in a while I look down and I'm like, aha, there you are. This beautiful plant. It has a tall stem, maybe about 2 or 3 feet. And it's just covered with whorls of these green, kind of ragged looking orchid blooms. So I find that one to be really interesting. It's not listed as a rare plant in New York State, but it is a vulnerable plant in New York. Something else that I think about when I think about rare plants are plants that people seek to find or would like to experience. And that always makes me think of American ginseng, Panax cinquefolius. That is one of my favorite plants, mainly because of its ties to our culture and its agroforestry uses. That plant was nearly extirpated or removed from New York State and much of the Northeast, because it's so valuable, so sought after. So it's quite uncommon to stumble upon a wild plant, let alone a wild population. And in my years of wildflower hunting, I've seen some really impressive old populations of wild ginseng. And I think that's maybe one of my favorite experiences to have.
Now, that's a whole issue with the ginseng, because there's pirates and hunters and thieves.
Poachers, you got it.
And all the drama. So when you find a stand, do you kind of like keep it a secret?
Totally keep it a secret. I don't tell anyone. That plant is, in fact, it's internationally protected by CITES, the Convention of International Trade and Endangered Flora and Fauna, because it's so valuable, so sought after, particularly in the Catskill region. So on an annual basis, we do hold a workshop specifically on this plant because there's so much to talk about. And that happens every year in September with Bob Bifus, also known as Mr. Ginseng. He covers all of the ins and outs of that plant. And we do it in September because that's when we're entering into what's called hunting season for ginseng.
Okay, so now ginseng is endangered, and if I have it in my yard, should I just go out and dig it up and bring it in closer so that it can be safe? Or if I find rare stuff out in the woods, can I just bring them in and tuck them in a nice place in my house?
That's a hard no, Jean. Don't do that.
All righty.
Many of these plants that we're talking about, these spring ephemerals or ginseng, a lot of things that are sought after, they're quite finicky. They have a whole list of preferences and needs, and they're growing where they're growing for a reason because of what's there for them. So moving them would probably result in their death. So leave them where they are, maybe jot down where they are, and just go back and visit them.
Even if it's a really big clump?
Even if it's a really big clump. Yeah. Most places where you are, it would probably be illegal to do that. Like, for example, on state land, it's generally illegal to dig things up and take them home and then replant them.
Okay, we've been talking a lot on our other segments of the show about invasive plants, invasive insects, invasive diseases. How much do invasive plants threaten our native wildflower population? And what observations have you made about climate change? That's another big threat.
Both of those are huge threats to consider. Invasive plants have a tendency to outcompete. That's one of the reasons why they're categorized as invasive. They will generally extend their seasons beyond the growing seasons of our native plants. For example, in the spring, some of the first plants you'll see really kind of putting their foliage out are those invasives like honeysuckle or multiflora rose. So they're getting a jump start and they're putting out their leaves and they're kind of shading out and taking over the habitat or the environment of our native plants. Our native plants will often go dormant when that happens. So if you mitigate the impacts of those invasive species, generally through removing them, those native plants tend to bounce back. We do see that if you are revisiting those areas that you're working to restore, you'll get those native plants kind of back. But if you wait too long, they'll peter out and kind of go away. And then with climate change, that's another huge impact. We're generally thinking about the shifts of temperature and the way we're receiving precipitation. So we're getting more extremes of temperatures, colder winters, hotter summers. And with precipitation, we're getting longer periods of drought. And then when the rain comes, it comes heavier, more intensely, and results in kind of this flooding effect. So these plants that have evolved here and are used to what the climate usually offers maybe aren't getting that anymore. I think the droughts, those periods of dryness, are what can really impact our wildflowers. That can cause them to go dormant. It can reduce their resources, so they're maybe not able to bloom. Another really big impact that I wanted to highlight is deer browse. So if the plant miraculously is able to escape the invasives, it's able to adapt to the climate change, then we have this huge deer population problem. So if the plant's doing well, then a deer might stumble along and find this what it finds to be a delicious wildflower and will bite the leaves off, bite the flower off, and that can ultimately result in the death of those plants as well. So we do a whole host of education on deer browse. We have a couple workshops and monitoring efforts that we're engaged in called AVID, Assessing Vegetation Impacts of Deer. And this is another training that you can engage with to learn about the impacts on trees, shrubs, and wildflowers.
And you have a big AVID procedure up in the Siosla Forest, correct?
We do. We have about 5 different deer exclosures. Mm-hmm. So these are fenced-in areas that we're removing deer from and then monitoring the results of deer being not present in those stands. We also have control plots that are outside those fenced-in areas. So we're able to compare what's just happening in the wild without any protection. And then we use those and go to other locations wherever people are interested to put on trainings and teach people how to set up these own monitoring plots so you can become a citizen scientist and monitor the plants that you love on your own.
Have you had any results from your exclosure experiment? Does it make a difference?
Absolutely. There's one that we installed in what was called a patch clear cut. We do active harvesting on the model forest. So we did a 1/2-acre patch cut where we cut all the trees down to the ground. And then we established a deer exclosure in the middle and watched to see what would happen. And if you stand like looking down the fence line and look to the left and see inside the exclosure, you'll see tree shoots that are growing 10, 12, 15 feet tall. And if you look on the right, there's nothing. There's like raspberries growing at ground level and that's it.
How many years have you been doing this project?
There's different exclosures that have been installed by different folks. The AVID protocol established from researchers at Cornell University, and they established our first 3 deer exclosures maybe in 2014. And they've been monitoring both the results of different types of fencing, so they can relay those to landowners. And then we came in after our harvest in 2016, and areas that were cut, we wanted to protect to make sure we got trees to regrow there. So we established those 2 additional exclosures and have been monitoring those since 2016.
So you're accumulating great quantities of data.
We are. There's a database for all that data. The AVID program has its own website. All the monitoring that one does, including ourselves, we input that data onto the database. And then that will ultimately be utilized by the DEC to make deer management population decisions.
So if the native plants are crowded out by the invader plants, what's the harm to the whole ecosystem? Don't they just kind of fill in the niche? Are there reporting systems in place for endangered species?
Unfortunately, it's quite a ripple effect. If we lose a few species, those other animals, insects, pieces of the ecosystem that benefit from them don't have them anymore. Like maybe a wildflower was the source of nectar for a pollinator. If that plant was outcompeted by the invasive species, that pollinator might not have the correct food source for them to complete their life cycle. So the invasive species not only outcompete what we would like to have here, what's evolved to be here, what we need to be here, but they do not fill the void that those plants served.
Okay, so that's why in the pine bush in Albany, everything is geared to the fire culture and saving the Karner blue, which is a really boring looking little blue butterfly.
I think it's cute.
It's cute, but it's not nearly as dramatic as the monarch.
Mm.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in monitoring and helping out to relay this information to state agencies, there's a great application called IMAP Invasive. And you can use that to identify where populations of invasive species exist. And that's all relayed to the Natural Heritage Program, which is an arm of the DEC. And they can use that information to make management decisions.
And okay, now there's another one that we've used called iNaturalist for ID, which I think can give you some of that information as well. It doesn't monitor.
It doesn't monitor, but iNaturalist is perhaps one of the only identification apps that I would recommend for folks to use. Okay. I generally think that the identification apps take a little bit of the fun and skill out of plant ID, but I understand that sometimes when you're new to the topic or looking to become involved, it's a great way to get people started. That one is very accurate, and it has a host of people who review pictures that you take and submit to make sure your identification is correct. And you can use that towards invasives, towards any plants, or towards endangered plants to record where they are.
You are listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson and Columbia County and Acre and Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreene.org or on Facebook. Wildflowers and foraging are today's topic areas, and we are joined by Tracy Testo, a program coordinator in the area of natural resources and the environment for Cornell Cooperative Extension. Let's dig into the topic of foraging. So Tracy, we know your expertise ranges beyond wildflowers, so let's talk about another type of wilderness walks you conduct. Foraging is a very big buzzword these days, and as I understand it, foraging is a great way to get to know your land as a resource for local foods. It can be a wonderful family activity and comes with a greater understanding of our interactions with the natural world. Could you define foraging for us?
It's really quite simple. It's simply just stepping outside, identifying or finding a plant that has some type of edibility or medicinal use, and picking that plant to consume it. It's often thought to be this maybe unapproachable topic or subject, which is quite ironic to me because most of these plants that are edible or useful can be really found right in our backyard. A lot of times when participants come to our class or ask me about foraging, they think that we have to hike miles deep into the woods to find these edible plants when they're literally everywhere.
And do you typically have to cook those plants, or are many of them edible raw?
Both. Many are edible raw. And unlike our cultivated foods that might be exposed to some agricultural products, these plants that are growing in the wild don't really need to be washed as long as you are careful about where you found them. And many can be just great additions raw. They can be cooked. They can be processed into something greater. An example of that would be perhaps acorns turning into flour, or fruits and berries turning into like a fruit leather or a jam.
I know you've got several foraging walks during the year, and if you could tell us where you do those, other than maybe the Ciosla Forest, which we're going to assume, but where you should not forage, and how do you make sure something's safe?
Good questions. Every spring, we have a foraging walk at the Hudson office, and every fall, we have a fall foraging walk at the Acre office. I generally bring in collaborators or co-presenters because there's just so much to know, so much to teach, and I've found it helpful to not only take a little pressure off, but to make sure we meet the needs of all of our participants. And as for where not to forage, try to think of what's happening on that land. What's the land use? Perhaps what's the history? If you're walking along a road with heavy traffic, you might not want to consume what's growing on the roadside because of debris or chemicals or emissions that might come from the vehicles that pass.
Like the tar-coated blackberries?
You got it. Yeah, not too appetizing. So try to use your common sense and think about past land uses.
Okay, now we're talking about names. So somebody's wandering around and they say, oh, that's a such and such, and they look it up, and the name they're using is wrong, and they're poisoning themselves. How are they sure about what they're looking at?
So most people utilize common names. I do it in daily conversations, but I'm always making sure to stay tuned into the Latin names of the plants. The Latin names were identified to relate to how the plants sometimes look or how they were used. And Latin, as we all know, is a dead language, so it's not going to evolve or change, and it stays consistent. Common names can be really dangerous. A great example is the term hemlock. That could refer to a hemlock tree or a poison water hemlock, which would kill you. So maybe using common names in daily language is acceptable, but making sure you're familiar with plant families, those genuses of the plant, and referring to your guides to make sure you're looking at the right plant.
Okay, so if somebody wants to take one of your foraging classes, how do they find out when they're scheduled and how to enroll?
A great way to hear about everything we offer is to get on our quarterly program listing. You can find a link to do this on our website. You can call or email anybody who works for our association, and we get your name and email on there. So every quarter when we create these quarterly program listings, they're emailed or snail mailed out to anyone who wants to see them. In addition to that, we send out monthly notifications. We have everything listed on our website, and we have a great media expert who puts everything on Facebook, Instagram, all the social media places.
You're making foraging sound easy, but there's a lot of things to watch out for.
You got it.
So what's a good way to get started?
A good way to get started would be to come to a class or engage with some type of professional. I usually recommend that people try to become acquainted with one plant and spend a year with that one plant. I know it seems kind of arduous and time consuming, but it's worth it in the long run for your safety. And spending that 1 year with a plant and watching its evolution through the season will teach you so much. For example, there are plants that have different edible parts that should be consumed in different seasons. So as you're observing and spending time with a plant, you can see what parts are growing, where the plant's putting energy to, and that's a clue of what parts you should consume because it would be most flavorful, most nutritious. Dandelions are a great example of this. When they first emerge in the spring, they're sending all their energy to their leaves, and they're usually tender and delicious and great additions raw. If you wait a little bit more into the season, you'll start to see flower spikes be sent up. So the leaves become less tender. That's when you might want to consider cooking them if you really want to eat them. Or you would turn your attention towards those blooms that are being created. The buds of dandelions can be eaten. They're delicious pickled. They taste quite like capers. And then once the flower blooms and opens up, it's very sweet, and those petals can just be pulled apart and added as a garnish to really anything, a salad, a soup, a stir fry. Brightens things up and adds a little bit of sweetness. Then after the flower has passed, it's starting to turn to seed. So it's interesting to watch that evolution happen. And following the seed production, the plant will start to send all of its energy back into its roots. The roots are also edible. So as you're watching this happen, perhaps in the late fall, that would be a clue to dig up the roots of the plant. And I like to chop them up and kind of roast them in the oven. And then I use them as a tea or coffee substitute.
I knew about dandelion leaves. I had no idea that the other parts of the dandelion were edible.
Yeah, there's quite a few plants that are like that.
Well, there's some that are poisonous that are like that. My very favorite, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous plant, is pokeberry. And I don't remember its Latin name, but I'm sure we can find it. It's I don't know if you know the song Poke Salad Annie.
You've told me about this song. I've listened to it. It's fun.
Yeah. And it refers to picking the poke greens or salads, and they cook them up like spinach. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty toxic. You want to go into that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So when the plant emerges in the spring, it's almost unrecognizable to its adult counterpart. So that's a great example of a plant that you'd really want to watch and sit with to make sure you know what you're looking at. So in the spring, when the shoots emerge, they're quite tender and they're a delicious edible, even raw. But when the plant matures, it produces these beautifully brilliant purple berries that are quite toxic. So you want to really know not only the identification of the plant that you want to eat, but specifics of all the parts. Another interesting example is elderberry. There's kind of a lot of buzz about elderberry as a crop that's coming into the U.S. It's been quite popular in Europe, but we Americans are just kind of getting caught on to it. And the berries should not be consumed raw. They need to be cooked and exposed to heat before they can be safely consumed.
Really? I eat them raw.
I've popped a couple in my mouth. They're tasty. I'm not sure exactly what the toxin is, but I think it's one that accumulates in your system. Okay. So just a couple little nibbles isn't going to hurt you. But if you're like totally gorging yourself on the berries, you might find yourself in some trouble down the road.
And what about the rest of the plant?
Of the plant is not edible.
It's not just the berries at a certain point.
And the flowers can be utilized as well.
There's a bunch of other wildflowers that you can use in salads. I'm thinking, you know, things like chickweed or violets.
Sure. Yeah, chickweed is one of my favorite spring greens. That plant tends to be found in disturbed areas, usually people's vegetable gardens, and it's actually a great little ground cover. So I like to leave it and it cohabitates with all my cultivated plants. So those flowers can be eaten. Blue violets are delicious. The white ones can be eaten as well. The yellow ones should be avoided. Those ones have toxicity. So the purple ones are so common. They fill up people's lawns generally. Flowers have historically been used to be candied, kind of like coated in sugar and used as decorations on cakes or something like that. But they can be great raw additions to salads. The leaves of the violets are also edible, and they're a natural thickener. So if you're looking to make a soup or you want something that might need like cornstarch to thicken it up, you can just add some violet leaves in and it'll do the same thing.
Now you list hairy bittercress, but that's supposed to be a cool weather edible.
Yeah, bittercress, there's a few different ones. There's hairy bittercress, wintercress, and another one that's escaping me. But those are all really hardy plants that are one of the last greens to be out and one of the first greens to show up after the snow melts.
Okay.
They have these basal leaves that have lobes that get smaller and smaller as they go down.
Oh, down the stem?
The stem. And those can be eaten raw, cooked in salads, and the flowers can be eaten as well. But once the flowers start to emerge, the leaves become even more bitter than they were to start with. And the bitterness is a bit of a spring tonic. It's kind of a little bit of a rejuvenation for our system after the long winter without maybe a lot of tender.
Like rhubarb does.
Exactly.
It's like a tang.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the word cress makes me think of watercress. And you know, we watch Downton Abbey and we want little watercress sandwiches.
You can have those.
Now that grows clearly in water.
It does.
And is that a common thing?
That you find in flowing cool waters. I don't generally see that plant very often, but it's definitely out there. I guess I don't tend to forage in wetland areas quite often. Oh. That's one that is also equally as delicious, very tender, can be eaten raw, and you don't have to wash it because the stream already did it for you.
Now, is that a case where you have to watch out for if you're in the wilderness and you worry about beaver fever?
Sure.
So maybe you should wash it?
Yeah, perhaps. I usually err, I guess, lesser on the side of caution with those ones. Yeah. But like I said, just be cognizant of the land use around you. If you're aware of a beaver dam upstream, then yes, for sure, wash the plant.
Or a cattle yard.
Yeah, that's usually what I tune into a little bit more, like what pollutants from human or animal activity might be entering the soil or the water systems. If you're in an area with a lot of agriculture, make sure you either know what practices are being used in those fields or provide yourself with enough buffer so you've moved away from any areas that might have been impacted.
I'm a big fan of onions.
Me too.
Wild onions and wild chives. And what the heck are ramps? They're a big fashionable thing.
Ramps are important to talk about, and that kind of ties into our sustainability issue. So ramps are also called wild leeks. Those are our forested wild onions, and they show up in kind of deep, more rich mesic soils. They like a lot of nutrients. They are very slow growing. They take about 8 to 10 years to mature, meaning from growing from seed to being able to produce their own seed to reproduce. They're delicious, sweet, tender, young greens that you can find. Many people have generally dug up the bulbs to use them like traditional onions, but they have 2 or 3 leaves that emerge above ground, and those can be eaten and utilized in the same way, and they have the same flavor as the bulbs do. So I like to turn to the leaves to harvest so I'm not impacting the wild populations. A lot of restaurants are really interested in ramps or wild leeks, so some of the more commercial foragers might go out into the woods and dig up whole areas of ramps. Sometimes they can grow in quite large populations, so one might think that they're safe to dig a lot of, but those large populations are few and far between. So those areas should really be protected and stewarded. When we think about sustainable harvest of plants, we generally recommend 1/3 or less to make sure that the plant populations remain healthy and intact. With ramps, I would bring this way down, maybe to 10% at max if you're going to consider digging the bulbs. Luckily, ramps can be cultivated, so I would recommend if you're interested in these plants and maybe have a little bit of time, get some seed, plant them in your woods or the edge of your lawn, and look to steward your own population that you can feel comfortable and safe about consuming. There's a lot of state land that I hike nearby in the Catskills, and there's patches of ramps that I've been observing for the past 5 or 6 years. And the ones that are close to the trails, every year I watch diminish and diminish to just a few plants that are left. They're being over-harvested. Yeah. And I want to be realistic about the fact that people want to eat the bulbs. Mm. So like I said, try to follow that rule of 10% or less. You can notice that they grow in clumps. So you could carefully dig up a clump and thin those clumps. So you can actually help steward that population rather than harm it if you would like to.
You can't take them home and plant them in your yard.
You're not supposed to.
You can buy the plants. They're costly because of this.
And so are the seed. They're expensive.
Yeah. So there is a way to build your own population.
There is. Yeah. And I would highly recommend giving it a shot.
But there's also a lot of foraging that can be done to make teas out of. From what I'm seeing, it's clover and plantain.
Clover and plantain are great tea additions. There's really a ton of stuff out there that's great for tea. We'll talk about plantain for a minute. That generally populates people's lawns. If you're looking for a nice grassy lawn, that tends to be the bane of some people's existence. It was referred to as white man's footprint because it was thought to be brought here by European settlement. And Native Americans would say wherever the white man went, the broadleaf plantain would follow because it creates these kind of flat impressions in the lawn and almost looks like somebody stepped there. And it was brought here intentionally because of all its medicinal uses and its desire to be medicine, tea, food. So the leaves, if you've seen it before, it has these really obvious veins that run through the leaves. And those can be dried and used for tea. They could be consumed, maybe cooked, but they're generally a little tough. And those veins are kind of thick and stringy. It sends up these flower spikes, though, that almost look like little baby corn on the cob. And those can be eaten raw, or they can be roasted or cooked, kind of like asparagus, you might relate them to. And then after the seeds have matured, they can be harvested off and used as an edible seed as well, perhaps to make crackers or something like that. And that has a lot of psyllium in the plant, and that's often sought after as a medicine.
Now, that's the roughage stuff?
That's the roughage stuff, yeah. That's a good way to put it. Purple clover is a great addition to teas. It has a natural sweetness, a really nice color. It's aromatic and tasty. I don't really feel like I need to add anything else to make it more palatable, I guess. My favorite flower to use as tea is yarrow, Achillea millefolium. And that, there's some debate over whether or not that's native or naturalized, but regardless, it's present, it's here, it's part of the carrot family. So it has like an umbel, flat, white flower. And it's actually a ton of little beautiful flowers that make up the whole. And I like to use that to add to other tea blends. It's thought to have the ability to bring out the flavor and complement whatever you brew it with.
Which part of the yarrow do you use?
You can use any part. You can use the leaves, the flowers. So for example, if I brew it with spearmint or some type of mint, it makes the flavor just much more defined. Herbs are so plentiful. So mints, I've mentioned thyme already. We've already talked about onions. Those things are there. They grow abundantly and they're so easy to collect in masses and dry. And then you just have these herbs on hand. You don't have to worry about buying them anymore.
What things do you include as targets when you go foraging? Nuts and berries, which I always make fun of, the nuts and berries, and mushrooms and seeds, and maybe some flowers. What are the top several?
So I guess with those, you're kind of at the mercy of the seasons. So different seasons highlight different staples. For example, spring, I just immediately think of edible greens, you know, fresh, tender plants that you're able to harvest and add to your salads. Once we start transitioning into summer, then we shift to more of the berries, more of the seeds. A great example of the seeds might be sugar maple seeds. You know, those little helicopters that the sugar maples make? Those can be popped open and you can eat the seeds and they taste just like sunflowers. And then as we leave summer and move into fall, we start to shift more towards more nuts and I guess the kind of the tail end of the berry season. And when we get into the fall, that's when I start to get into preserving mode, where I'm going out and foraging all my seeds and nuts and berries and processing those and filling my pantries. And when you consider the mushrooms, those kind of exist throughout the season. Different species of mushrooms have their own season. For example, morels would be thought of as an early spring mushroom. Chanterelles kind of populate midsummer. And then chicken of the woods and hen of the woods kind of round the season out as you
those
move into
cool,
fall.
The cool orange ones?
The cool orange ones are the chicken cool. of the woods. Yeah.
Do you have a warning list of poisonous things to be aware of?
We don't have a list per se. This is when we draw people back to the need to be able to comfortably identify what you're eating. And when you think about poison plants, I would consider toxicity based on where they're growing to make them poisonous as well. So something that you would find to be safe to eat in one place might not be safe to grow in another. An example of that might be like an old apple orchard. We used to use a lot of heavy metals, things like arsenic to spray our apple trees, copper. So I would avoid consuming anything from those areas. Something that's a really popular wild edible is stinging nettle. That's usually consumed in the spring for its shoots or in the fall to collect leaves for tea. But that plant is considered a bioaccumulator. So if it's growing in an area where there might be toxicity in the soil, the plant is pulling that up into its aerial parts. So a plant that is considered an edible would then be turned into a toxic plant by what it's filled with. For just poisonous plants right off the bat, we always draw people's attention to poison ivy. During our foraging walks, folks get really excited and they start reaching out and touching everything. And unfortunately, a lot of the areas we visit have quite a bit of poison ivy. It's the world we live in. So we want people to know that one right off the bat. The other one that we reference and we already talked about is the poison water hemlock. That one is in the parsnip family. It might look similar to a vegetable you would grow. It even has a sweet smell to it, which is misleading. And that one is one of our few very deadly wild plants.
Now, they're not only toxic, but they give skin rashes and things like that too, right?
They do. Really, yes. Bad. I had an unfortunate run-in when I was learning that plant and got a rash on my face from smelling it.
General suggestions then for the newbies. Watch out for poison ivy and learn what poison ivy is because it has many, many faces.
It does. Yeah. It's a kind of morphing plant.
It is. It's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's impressive.
So what should you go out to be a cautious newbie?
I would say start to recognize the ecology or the habitat of areas that you're going into. For example, if you're looking to forage within the woodlands, you'll start to learn specific plants that grow there. If you're growing in old, maybe fields that are reverting back to woods, you'll be tuned into specific plants that might populate those areas. Wetlands is another great example. There's specific plants like cattail is a great reference for wetlands. So knowing the amount of water that's available there, the habitat that you're in, can really start to clue you into populations that you might expect. Use all of your senses. It's not just about visual. If you're fairly certain what a plant might be, there's probably other clues beyond just keying it out. Wild onions are a good example of that. If you see some shoots growing out of the ground and you think it might be wild onions, those ones are safe to kind of crush, smell, and use that to lead you to the fact that it's definitely an onion because it smells like an onion. Sure.
And the companion plant thing with the cattails, there's going to be potentially other water plants that are edible.
Exactly.
Things like that.
You are listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson and Columbia County and Acre and Greene County. Today's topics are wildflowers and foraging, and we are joined by Tracy Testo, a program coordinator in the area of natural resources and the environment. I understand that just as sustainable gardening is important, it's equally important to practice sustainable foraging. What should we be aware of to ensure that we follow good practice?
Yeah, we touched on this a bit with the ramps, but I'm glad we circled back to this because there's a lot of other recommendations. Like a great example is to be aware of the part of the plant you want to consume. So for example, if you're maybe just looking to eat a couple leaves off of a plant rather than harvesting the whole thing, you're not going to damage that population. Also, the more you start to learn about how plants grow and evolve will lead you down a path to identify recommendations of how much you can harvest. Stinging nettle grows in quite dense clumps and patches, and it has rhizomes that spread underground. So it's kind of difficult to damage a stinging nettle population by harvesting a few pieces of the plant. We talked about eating seeds. If you're collecting some seeds off of the maple tree, no big deal, you're not hurting the maple tree. But we generally like to stick to that rule of a third or less of the population. When you're considering that, try to consider whether or not other people might come along to also be harvesting a third. So just err on the side of caution. And as you're tuning yourself into a certain plant and how it grows, just use that to kind of guide you to make good decisions. Over-harvesting them could, you know, remove that population. And if you want to think about yourself, then you won't have that spot to go to and forage anymore.
I have a notation here somewhere. If you're going to make file powder from sassafras leaves, there's no need to uproot the sapling.
Well, sassafras is a delicious kind of historically used herb. It grows in maybe sandy soils. It's not terribly common, but when you see it, you'll notice that the leaves kind of look like little mittens.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful plant and it's very aromatic. So using that leaf and grinding it up and adding it to teas is something that's kind of just been a part of that plant's history. Okay. So when you're engaging with the plant like that, again, you know, you're not necessarily harming that plant's population, but just try to only harvest what you're going to need. You know, you don't need to take every leaf off of the plant. That would probably be way more than enough. So a better suggestion would just be to note where that plant is growing, take what you need at that time, and revisit it as needed.
So with a lot of these things, we've discussed that there's certain prime times. Different parts of the plant, of course, are going to be available at different times. Mushrooms are strange. I know there's seasons for the different ones.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got a mushroom walk scheduled and there's a drought for 3 weeks prior to that, or there's a bunch of heavy rain. Doesn't that all fluctuate? Doesn't that change around your population? And how do you go accordingly?
Again, you're really at the mercy of Mother Nature with that one. We schedule 2 mushroom forays each summer at the Sayusa Model Forest. And if there's a drought that is preceding that walk, we will have to reschedule because those mushrooms will not be present. So everyone kind of loses out when those droughts happen. It's really a bummer.
So let's get personal. Do you have a favorite grocery item in the forest that you anticipate all year?
again, with spring being my favorite time to look for wildflowers, it's also when I'm just really itching for some foraged goods from our area. So any of the spring greens that I might find, I'm really kind of dying for by the time it hits. But when thinking about all of the plants that I like to consume, I keep coming back to black locusts, which might be unexpected. Every year in the beginning of June, for this 1 week window, black locust puts out this amazing show of blooms. And as some of you might know, black locust is part of the pea family. It's a legume. So its flowers are pea-shaped, very fragrant, and so delicious. They're great to be consumed raw. You can take the whole flower cluster and batter them and fry them and make a fritter. My favorite thing to do with them is steep them in water to take the flavor out of the flower, put it in the water, and then mix in sugar to make a simple syrup with that flavor. It's almost tropical, like jasmine. I don't know if you can kind of think to the time of early spring when
the scents are awesome.
And that's exactly what it tastes like. And they have like a satisfying crunch to them. And the fact that they're so fleeting makes me really desire them. So you have 1 week at the beginning of June, and that week could be devastated by rain, so that 1 week window could turn into a day. And they're often pretty high up, so they can be a bit of a feat to even get to. So I like the challenge of those, and the reward is just phenomenal. Mark your calendars.
Exactly. So let's dig in a little bit more about mushrooms. You know, you hear all these stories about people getting poisoned by mushrooms. So what's a good rule of thumb for those who think it's a good idea to cruise around looking for mushrooms to eat? Oh, and what's a toadstool?
Well, you're not the only one who's fearful of mushrooms. This is really a part of our culture. We here in this part of the world are just not really comfortable or generally raised kind of growing up with the tradition of foraging wild mushrooms. So it makes it seem a bit unapproachable. And for those who want to learn how to eat them, take a few steps back and just learn how to identify them first. Their parts are wildly different from plants, so getting to know those can be a huge feat of its own. I would highly recommend taking a class, going out with a professional, and really taking your time, probably more than a year, of watching these mushrooms to figure out what's what. There's a few that are really obvious and thought to be safe, but err on the side of caution. Most times when you hear about people being poisoned by mushrooms, it's generally people from another part of the world who move to this country and they go out and forage and find something that they found in their home and they would swear that it's the same species, but it's not because we're in a totally different environment here. Those mushrooms that are feared are all generally in one family, the Amanitas. And that has the destroying angel is what it's called. It's a pretty inconspicuous white mushroom. It has a cap, gills, a stem, and a ring, what's called an annulus, around the stem. It also kind of comes out of an egg shape that's just underground. So you can use these really distinct features to figure out that that's a mushroom you wouldn't even want to think about eating. What I find to be kind of interesting about all this is that every mushroom is safe to touch, smell, even to taste, as long as you're spitting it out. A lot of mushroom experts will use taste as a way to identify what a mushroom is, but they'll promptly spit it out and then decide what it tasted like. The poison ones taste bad. But you know, when I think about this in comparison to plants, I feel like there's so many more plants that are harmful than mushrooms, when there's really just a select few of mushrooms that will actually kill you. A lot of mushrooms might taste bad. They might give you an upset stomach or make you feel kind of off, but not very many of them are actually deadly toxic. Unfortunately, if they are deadly toxic, they affect your organs, usually your liver, and there's not much to do to come back from that.
How many poison mushrooms are there in this area?
Just a handful. I can only think of a few off the top of my head that are deadly poisonous. Okay. The Galerinas, which grow out of wood and are kind of a brown little mushroom that look almost similar to shiitakes. And then the Amanitas are ones you want to avoid. Most of the Amanitas are not too safe to consume, except for one that's delicious and can be eaten raw. And a toadstool, that's simply just your kind of classic, iconic mushroom that actually generally looks like one of the members of the Amanita family. So it's like, I think of like a cartoon image of a red mushroom cap with white patches on it and then a big fat stem. That's a perfect little spot for a frog or a toad to sit on.
Our cooperative extension has classes. Well, don't you, Tracy? I've seen you running around with a drill and a hunk of wood. Are they scheduled regularly?
They are. So when you see us with those hunks of wood and with the drill, we're generally aiming to grow shiitake mushrooms. These are an amazing food source. They're a great crop. So we hold a workshop every spring in April. And then we have Bob Bifus come in to partner with us on that one. So he teaches a lot about the biology of mushrooms, a lot about the different species, and then we shift into a hands-on portion of the workshop where we teach participants to what's called inoculate a log. So you take a log that's been freshly felled or cut from the forest. It's a hardwood species, maybe sugar maple or oaks of some kind. Drill a bunch of holes with an angle grinder or a heavy-duty drill, and then insert or inoculate the log with mushroom spawn. So you can take the mycelium of the mushroom, the perennial vegetative part, and it grows out on grain or sawdust. You can purchase this from a company. And then you insert it in the log, wax it off. You let it sit for a year in the shade, usually in the canopy of some evergreens. And then after a year, that mycelium will colonize the log and it'll be ready to start to fruit. And one of the best reasons shiitake is an amazing crop is because you can make it fruit when you want to. You pick up the log, you shock it by dunking it in water, and then you take it out, lean it up, and within a week, it'll be covered with shiitake mushrooms ready for the picking. Come visit the model forest and see our demonstration of our shiitake laying yard.
So as a grazer, do you find any invasives that are yummy that you can like graze out of existence?
For sure. We focus quite a bit on invasives when we hold our foraging walks. And invasives are really fun because everything we talked about regarding sustainable foraging goes out the window. Eat it all. Some great examples that we like to highlight are Japanese knotweed. Many of you are familiar with that plant as really evading and colonizing stream banks and outcompeting everything else. When it first emerges as young shoots, they're tender and snap right off.
Like asparagus.
Like asparagus. You know that they're tender and good to eat if they snap just like asparagus, but they taste a little bit more like rhubarb. And you can do a lot with it. You can just eat them raw. I like to cut them in half and put peanut butter on them, kind of like ants on a log, like you would do with celery. I also like to cook them down and then spread it out on a baking sheet and make it into a fruit leather. So that's a way that I can cut it, put it in a jar, and store it. Japanese knotweed is really rich in antioxidants. Resveratrol is the one that's most noted. And it's a great medicine. So it's not only a delicious food, but it's a good medicine for your body.
It's been a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and expertise. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program, as well as the production support from Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let us help your garden grow.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreen.org, visit us in Hudson or in Accra, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below.